Welcome to the Ripple Revolution podcast. In this podcast, we take a new look at how we think about making a difference with an approach that integrates living an energized life and making the world a better place. Today, I'm interviewing Kevin Salwin, co-author of The Power of Half. In 1996, Kevin and his wife Joan were living what they thought was the American dream. After leaving his job as national small business editor at the Wall Street Journal, Kevin had founded a media company and Joan was a partner at Accenture. Living in a beautiful, historic Atlanta home worth nearly $2 million, his family was caught, without realizing it, in an ever-expanding cycle of more and bigger. But that all changed when, prompted by a 14-year-old daughter with an enormous social conscience, they decided to sell their house, move into a smaller one, and use half the proceeds to make a difference. The Power of Half is their story.
So, Kevin, I am so excited to be having a chance to talk with you on this interview. Thanks so much for being with us on the Ripple Revolution podcast. You and your daughter Hannah have co-written a book. So let's start with that, a book called The Power of Half. Tell me a little bit more about that book.
The Power of Half is a memoir of our family's journey from being a family that was a typical consuming yuppies with a couple of consuming kids to one that started to live around the idea of how much is enough and how much do we really need. And it's the story of our family's decision at the urging of Hannah, who was then 14, to sell our big, beautiful house, move into one half its size, and use half the funds to try to make the world better. And the book goes through that journey of how we decided how we were going to invest the funds off of the house, and how we went through our as we jokingly like to refer to it, our moment of insanity, and then what we're doing now with those funds.
Excellent. So how did the whole process get started? That sounds like a little bit of insanity there that is not your average family project.
Yeah, I think we were the type of family who while we were keeping up with the Joneses and the Feinsteins and about everybody else you could think of, we were as oblivious and as blind to the flow of our lives as I think many people are. I mean, it was a complete lack of consciousness about how we were living. And I say this even though we were a family that was participatory within our community. I mean, I've been on the Habitat for Humanity board for 9 years. I've been building houses for 20. My wife's been very involved with United Way and with a bunch of other charities, and our kids have always been involved since they were little with doing things in the community. And yet, on the other side of our lives, we were essentially sleepwalking, and moving through this, work, spend, treadmill, this cycle of living in an increasingly big way, just so that we could, just because we could. And that we ran into problems with that in a couple of places that really started to manifest itself. Number one was in our car, where we would climb into our car and the kids would hop in the back and they would put in a DVD, because there were little TV sets in the back of the headsets, and pop in their headphones, and then we stopped communicating in the car. The bigger issue was actually in our home, where we had bought this beautiful 6,000 square foot home that Joan referred to as her dream house, and I would come home at the end of the day and I'd walk in the front door and say, "Hey everybody, I'm home," and the dogs would come running up. They were all excited, and nobody else even knew I had walked in the door, and that was I describe it in the book as kind of being as a family had got was going through this period of erosion, and it was like erosion against a shore. It was like this steady chip, chip, chip away from what was healthy. There was no tidal wave. There was no tsunami. There was no cataclysmic event. It was just this steady erosion of the quality of our relationships. And when Hannah was 14, I was driving her home from a sleepover, and we pull up at a very familiar stoplight about a mile from our home. And she looks to her left, and there is a man sitting against a chain link fence. He's wearing raggedy clothes. It's clear he hasn't showered or bathed in days. And he's got a handmade cardboard sign written with Sharpie. And it says, four simple words: hungry, homeless, please help. And, we're thinking, what should we do with the guy? I typically carry Chick-fil-A cards in my car, so I'll give the guy, $5 in Chick-fil-A card, and that kind of thing. I didn't have any. I'm looking around my car. I look in my glove compartment. All I have is like ketchup packets and napkins and stuff like that. And Hannah over in the passenger seat is having a completely different experience, because she looks over and there's a beautiful black Mercedes that has at the very same moment pulled up on her right side. And now she's like one of those bobblehead dolls at the ballpark, It's like she's toggling back and forth between the have and have not in our community, just a mile from our house. Hmm. And she says, Dad, if that guy over there didn't have such a nice car, then the guy over here could have a meal. And I said, well, yeah, but, what would happen tomorrow or the next day? And if we didn't have such a nice car, he could have a meal. So anyway, light turns green, we head home, and I can tell that Hannah, who is, who's a bleeding heart anyway, she's not done with this conversation. And she can't wait to get to the table to sit down with Joan, my wife, and Joseph, our son, who's 2 years younger than Hannah, and talk about this. And she tells the whole story, and she says, I want to be a family that makes a real difference, not just one that talks about making a difference. And Joan says, well, hon, we are very generous people. And she reminds her of all the things we do. And I'm looking in Hannah's eyes, and all I can see is her thinking, this is the lamest garbage I've ever heard. and Hannah takes another shot, and she says, I really want to do something. I want to do something big. And Joan, in sort of a moment of frustration, says, what are you willing to give up for this? How are you willing to change your life? You want to give up your room? You want to give up this house? And Hannah's face brightens. And I'm thinking to myself, I am in deep trouble here. I'm in really deep trouble. And sure enough, as it turned out, we made within the next day or so, we made a decision as a family to sell our house and move into one half the size, and then use the funds to try to make the world better.
And thus the adventure began.
Yeah, it's a long way to get to the adventure began, isn't it? But that's our family's life story right there. You've heard it all.
Absolutely. So one of the things that that I love, so I've been going back and reading your book again here, and one of the things that I love about the whole story is really just the family aspect of it, and I think that there's so much inspiration to that, and so much potential. The idea of doing something as a family and exploring this idea of what difference do we want to make, how do we want to do it, et cetera, et cetera. That has so much power. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. First, just what was your experience and the impact on you personally and the impact of the family on this process this process had?
Well, what's kind of interesting about this is that it was it's a collective experience and a set of individualized experiences that play into that. So picking up really from that point that I left off, so we make this decision to sell our house and give away half the money. The interesting thing was we didn't actually even know where we wanted to use those funds. And so Joan looked around for some resources that we could use to sort of guide us through a process of trying to decide this. She couldn't she couldn't find anything, so she actually invented a process to do this. That process sort of went like this. We would get together three or four Saturdays a month, just over bagels or frozen pizza or something, and just talk about the issues of the world. And we talked about just about everything you can think of. We talked about veterans affairs and the environment and healthcare and poverty and lack of clean water, et cetera, et cetera. And each time we would discuss the issues and we would try to figure out, okay, where could we plug in with the amount of money we were talking about, which we were talking about something along the lines of $1 million. How could we really make a difference? What we did at that point, what might have been the most radical thing that we did, and that was that for this project, we decided to completely flatten our family hierarchy. In other words, one person, one vote, like with the irrational hormonal teenagers having the exact same vote as we very wise adults, right? And you asked about my personal experience. This made me incredibly uncomfortable at first. And I pushed back to Joan. I said, well, how do we tell our kids, no, you can't play video games or watch TV before you finish your homework if they have equal say to us over $1 million? You know, it just seemed disproportionate to me. And Joan, who had been a partner in change management at Accenture, said, just stick with this. You watch. You'll see that our kids will make better decisions across the board. And in fact, you will see that they will come with a different level of engagement. And those two things precisely happened. I started to notice within about 2 to 3 weeks that when our kids came to our Saturday morning meetings and they were asked questions, they were fully engaged because they knew, even at the ages of 12 and 14, that they were going to be listened to and that they were participatory on a fullness and a level that most families don't have. And that was actually fascinating. My kids make better decisions across the board now, in part because of this project. So,
wow, that's amazing just in and of itself. Never mind the rest of the project, just the impact that has.
Well, you know what's fascinating about it is it's kind of a duh moment in some ways, because if you. I think what we've learned through this whole project is if you offer people the opportunity at power and control, they will, in general, make better decisions. And I don't mean, absolute power, but I'm talking about, we find that in all kinds of places, and we can get into where later, but, that empowerment piece has been a critical part of this whole project.
Well, that's excellent. So as you are, as you're looking at this, and clearly you learned some things along the way, figured some things out, realized some things, say there are parents that are interested in saying, I don't necessarily want to sell my house and do all of that, but I'd really like to engage my kids in this way, and I'd really like to make a project where we're really looking at what kind of difference do we want to make, how do we want to make it, what's important to us, etc. If you're coaching parents through that process, what would you suggest?
I think there's a couple ways to come at it. Number one is, regardless of whether you decide to sell your house, and by the way, everybody who's listening to this can breathe a little easier. We don't advocate that anybody else sell their home. That's what we had more than enough of. But the reality is everybody has more than enough of something. And I'll give you the simplest example and the cheapest example. If you watch 4 hours of television a week, if you cut that in half and cut that down to 2 hours a week, now all of a sudden you have a new resource that's available, and that's 2 hours free time in your week. If everyone in your family does the same thing, now you have this opportunity at using this new resource collectively, right? You have a way to take the most important people in your world, your family, and connect them during this 2 hours. How you use that 2 hours is completely up to you. You can use it to sing in a nursing home. You can use it to clean up a neighborhood park. You can use it to work on a political campaign if that's what you want to do. And each one of these things, what I always encourage parents is, let the kids lead a little bit on this stuff, right? So let's go back to the 2 hour example. If you've got 2 hours free and it's Saturday morning at 9 o'clock, and that's when your family is going to do something. And if the kids really care about animals, and you don't care so much about animals, you'd rather work in a poverty related thing. Go to the Humane Society and go work for those 2 hours taking care of the pets. It's fine. There's enough problems in the world so that your kids can have their say. If you have multiple kids and they have different interests, then rotate. Have a way to do it so that, you know, 1 week you go to the homeless shelter and you read to the little kids who are there. And 1 week you might go to the food bank and sort food there. And so each person has an opportunity to have that be their week, their opportunity. And by the way, whenever we did that as a family, we would always go out for a pancake breakfast or donuts afterward, because, you know, the kids always thought, hey, I'm getting a treat for doing something good. But what Joan and I always realized was, hey, we have an opportunity to sit down together as a family and debrief and have more conversation and reengage on these issues. Completely light, completely fun.
Nice. So you're talking about Joan's process of helping figure out what is it that we want to focus on, what is it that we care about, et cetera. That she kind of created from scratch. Could you talk a little bit more about what that looks like and how people might apply that as part of the exploration?
Yeah, I think one of the crucial pieces was that she would bring resources to our table. The first whole couple of months were all about trying to sift through all of the issues of the world and where we thought we could participate best. And so as we started to focus in at that part on the issues we really cared about, she brought out a worksheet. And essentially it was a voting process where you had to circle the three issues that you cared the most about. And they were all of those issues that I mentioned earlier of poverty and clean water, et cetera. And then three issues you cared least about. And so essentially that created a vote count where we could sort through to narrow the number of issues of the world, because the issues of the world are so overwhelming, right? And so as we started to focus in, we started to realize, hey, poverty-related issues are the ones where we were collectively most engaged. And then we would have conversations about that. Okay, well, if we were to work on poverty-related issues, would we want to work in the U.S., in Atlanta? Would we want to work overseas, et cetera? And we would take votes on that. I'm telescoping the whole process. This took us weeks and weeks. But with each step, we would not move forward until we were unanimous. And if there wasn't some place for compromise, then we would have to go back and reset. But here's the really cool thing that happened. I know some of this sounds like it's a bit of a pain in the rump, but the really cool thing that happened is as we went through this process, our kids started to open up increasingly, and in fact, Joan and I started to open up increasingly about our values towards certain things. And we started to understand more about each other. And remember that erosion I talked about in terms of the quality of our relationships. This was the process that started the healing of that erosion. Now, all of a sudden, we started to know one another better. We could have a conversation about a different level of issue. Joan actually refers to it as our special family currency. That we have a way of, that we can talk to each other in a kind of shorthand and a kind of currency that is unlike any other family on the planet, because it's the Salwyn family's currency. And it came out of these meetings and out of these conversations. I guess I should tell listeners what we eventually did with the with our funds. You know, unless you want to save this dramatically for the end, you know.
This is a great place for it.
we decided early on, fairly early on, a couple months in, that we wanted to work on poverty-related issues. We were already, as I said, doing a lot of work here in our hometown of Atlanta, and so we decided we wanted to work. In a place where poverty was at a completely different level from where it is domestically, so we decided we wanted to work in Africa, and it became increasingly important to us that our project was women focused, because this came out of our research too, that it had to begin and end with empowerment and opportunity for women, and it had to be from the bottom up. It had to be a grassroots based program that empowered people to fix their own future. And so we have invested nearly $1 million with an organization called the Hunger Project. It is a nonprofit that is headquartered in New York, but has a very small U.S. staff, and it works in 8 countries in Africa, as well as India, Bangladesh, and Mexico. And it helps people build a future of self-reliance and self-empowerment. And we work in 2 sets of villages in Ghana. That's where our funds are used. And we're where there are 20,000 people who are building a brighter future for themselves.
That's superb. So with that, there are a bazillion different organizations out there doing good in the world and such. How did you narrow in on them?
Mostly what we worked on going up to that point, and so now we're kind of in the middle 3 months period, was what are the characteristics that are really important about the organization we team up with. One step before that I should note is we decided not to start our own nonprofit. We thought that the world had plenty of organizations. It didn't need more, and it didn't need a Salwyn ego organization. What it really needed was us to get on a train that was already headed in the right direction. And so what we decided as we moved through was, as I said, it needed to be women-focused. It needed to be all about self-empowerment. It needed to be about people creating their own future. And then we started to research what types of organizations would do that. We narrowed it down to about 3 organizations that we really liked, and we interviewed them all. We did a day in New York. We all flew up there. That was one of our few extravagances. And we all flew up there, and we asked them to come meet with us. And, we had the opportunity to sit down face-to-face and really start to understand the differences in methodology and how they go about their business. And so the Hunger Project came out as the one that was absolutely positively the clear winner for us.
Excellent. So it sounds like it was really just a long funneling process to get to that decision. And then ultimately, they were really the clear winner. What made them the clear winner?
They had all the right characteristics. I mean, they are. They've been around a while. They have a methodology that flat out works. They're very reliant on the people on the ground. In other words, the Ghanaians to create their own future. They're very much about women being the leaders. Their model is holistic. So within these projects that they help Ghanaians build for themselves, they have they have a health clinic with a live-in nurse. They have a food storage facility. They have a community farm. They have a micro lending facility of a bank, and they have a library. They have a meeting room. And so it takes care of a lot of the different issues that they're not just doing wells, or they're not just doing bed nets or those kinds of things. And in reality, when you look at it, that's what people need to build a community that takes them to a different level. Much more holistic. And plus, we just absolutely loved the fact that there's no paternalistic, we're from the West, we're here to help you, or we're from the West, we're here to do it for you. It's very much about people building their own future. And so what we do is we wait for people to be ready to build their own future, and then we help inject resources at that time. So for instance, the first year that the Hunger Project goes into a village and starts to have conversation with the elders and with the community, there's no construction at all. There's conversation. And it's funny because the first time, invariably what happens is the first time the Hunger Project walks in to a community, the chief hands them a list and says, these are the things we need for you to give us. And that's become such a commonplace way for the developing world to deal with the developed world. Hey, you know, if you really care about us, you'll give us this stuff. And then the Hunger Project explains its methodology, sometimes says, hey, why don't you get in the car with us? We'll drive you to some of the other places where we've worked and leave you to talk with villagers there. Fascinating, because 6 months later, the Hunger Project will come back into the village and the same elders will meet. And this time they'll have another list. Here's the list of things that we have achieved on our own in the 6 months that you've been gone. And now you start to see that people are ready to build their own future. And that's, you know, that is a completely different mindset. And in fact, the first year to two are all about helping people recognize their own power to change their own lives.
Nice. And, you know, it strikes me that to some degree there's a parallel there in the empowerment perspective with what this project did with your kids, which is really you kind of put the reins in their hands, in addition to yours and Joan's.
Yeah, I think you're
to that.
Yeah, you're dead on about that. And you know, we have so much confidence in people to build a better, smarter future for themselves if they have the sense that they can, right? And what's interesting is that in the time since we've done our project, we have now, along with an absolutely brilliant social worker here in Atlanta named Ed Morris, built a program that helps kids in poor urban schools start to recognize their own power to change their own lives and their own trajectories. And we call this the Power of Half Schools Initiative, and we have taken it into the worst schools in Metro Atlanta. And it's been absolutely fascinating to see these kids who most of society has already written off as being the future criminals, and to see them start to make completely different decisions as they have gone through our program. It's just really powerful stuff.
That's excellent. You know, one of the things that I love about your family's story is not just, okay, here's this cool thing that we did and we feel good, et cetera, but the fact that you're sharing it, they're sharing it in the book, that you're sharing it with things like what you were just describing with the schools, and there is this then ripple that exists as a result of that, these ripples that exist, which is, you know, very much in line, oddly enough, with the ripple revolution idea. I know from seeing the various posts on the Power of Half Facebook feed, there have been here and there cool stories about things that people have done as a result of reading your book, the inspiration that they've gotten, etc. Does anything jump out at you as far as things that have felt particularly exciting to hear about, big or small? It doesn't have to be a huge thing, just things that are like, wow, that felt meaningful.
Well, I mean, I can. There's a couple that are home related that stand out just because of the size. I had a woman who came up to us, a year and a half or so ago, and she said, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know, I read your book, and I decided that we as a family should sell our house. So that's what we've done." And I couldn't help myself. I'm just such a bad person. I looked her in the eye and I completely deadpanned. We were just kidding. And her face dropped. I said, "Okay, now I'm kidding," you know. But so that was pretty amazing. And there's a guy who's a professor at in California who was talking to a woman who had gotten out of an abusive relationship and taken her two kids with her and was living in a shelter. And this guy did an amazing thing. He had heard our story, and he said, "I can do something that's bigger." And so he moved out of his house. He moved in with his mother into his old bedroom, and he rented his house to this mother and her two kids for $1 a month. And it was just so moving that it's just a marvelous act on its own. But, you know, for him to say, "Well, I had heard about this family in Atlanta, and I decided if they could do this, I could do something like this." Most of the stories are much smaller than that, and there's a beauty to that too. There's a group of kids in Rye, New York, in a middle school, who decided that collectively they were going to cut the time of their showers in half, so that they could save on, they could do good things for the environment and reduce their parents' water bills. And so they did. They all took little timers, took a regular shower, and then cut the time of their showers in half, and then worked to try to convince their parents that whatever price difference there was in their water bills, they should give away. It's just a beautiful little story. What did that take? It took almost nothing except for somebody to have a little inspiration, have a great idea, and go forward with it. And now they funneled a bunch of money into helping people who are in need on their utility bills, be able to bridge that gap.
Nice. And what I love about that, in addition to the direct impact that has, is it's also really planting the seed for just a mindset on how to engage with the world, and especially in the young people, it's kind of starting to really build that framework for how do I see the world. So that's completely inspiring.
Thank you. I just want to add. I mean, I know we're short of time, but I just want to add that, if you think about what we did, all we really did was we traded some stuff for more connectedness and closeness as a family. And, all we did was we realized we had more than enough of something, and everybody has more than enough of something. That, I think it's so easy.
Absolutely, and that again then is this mindset of simply looking for that opportunity of, okay, here's a way that I can engage in the world. What do I have more than enough of, and what can I do with that time, money, whatever it is? So
yeah,
I want to talk to you about this for hours, and the 30-minute format doesn't allow for that. So I'm going to wrap this up here, but I would love to be able to send people to find out more about The Power of Half and the book and ideas for what they might do, et cetera. Do you have a website that you can share with us?
Sure. Our family's website is thepowerofhalf.com, and we update that sporadically. I would also encourage people to go to the Hunger Project's website. If any of this inspires you to look at the Hunger Project, please look at that. That's thp.org. And most importantly, I would just encourage people to be bold in their decision making. You know, you can take a little risk with how much power you give your kids. You can take a little risk about how much is enough in your life. And I don't think any one of your listeners will ever regret that.
That's so excellent. So thank you so much for spending this time and sharing your experience and sharing your insights. And I know that you are one of the people out there that has long inspired me just watching your journey. And I had the chance to meet Hannah when you and your daughter were out in Seattle on a book tour, and was completely blown away by her. So you and Joan are clearly doing something right, and I'm really, really delighted that you decided to put the story out there in the world and create ripples with the books and everything else that you're doing. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Kurt. Thanks for all you do. Mm-hmm.